Welcome to Wait What, the history quiz where we laugh the past to keep from weeping about the present. I'm your host, Phil Ahrensberg. I'm a history nerd with a passion for illuminating the darker crevices of the human story. I'm joined today by a panel as erudite as they are entertaining. Let's meet them now. First off, she is an author, educator, and has +2d6 against red dragons. Please welcome back to the show, Heather Walpert-Gowron. Hey, Heather, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm good. Happy Friday.
Thank you. You too. I am on pins and needles to find out what we're talking about today.
Excellent. Excellent. I hope I won't disappoint. Next, he's a Ukrainian Foreign Legionnaire, and he'd like 4 fried chickens and a Coke, please. It's Aaron Clark. Hey, Aaron, how's it going?
Hey, Phil. I'm doing great. Good to be here.
Excellent. Excellent. And finally, she's a professor of English and visual culture at the University of Albany. It's Mary Valentis. Hi, Mary. How's it going?
It's going really well.
Excellent. Excellent. All right, kids, the format, as always, is simple. I'm going to describe some strange event or person from history and then ask you, the panel, questions about it. I will award points based on how much I enjoy the answers to those questions, and the person with the highest score at the end wins. Today, you'll be vying for bragging rights and, as always, a box of Captain Crunch cereal.
I'm still waiting for mine, just putting it out there.
It's on its way. It's on its way. Today's topic, medieval communist sex cult. Today's story is a tale of religion, politics, sex, and the abolition of civil liberties under a central authoritarian regime. I realize it sounds like current events, but all this went down in 1534. Aaron, you're nodding your head with confidence. Do you know today's topic?
Are we talking about the diggers or the levelers?
Neither. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Something you haven't heard of. All right. Well, round one begins now, and we do need to get some context. So let's do a little history. The roots of our story today go deep into European culture to write about the final collapse of the Roman Empire in the West. Never mind that Rome 2.0 was going strong in Constantinople, many miles to the east. We're not talking about them. We're talking about Western Europe. The stuff that one day would constitute Germany, England, France, Spain, what people mean when they say they're going on a European vacation. So here we are in the 500s, 600s, and Europe is kind of stumbling around. For the last 1,000 years or so, Rome, in one form or another, has been in charge. Everyone in the empire had been declared a full citizen. They are effectively Roman. They have currency and taxation and roads and mills and water. They had armies and bureaucracy. And now, not suddenly, but certainly gradually and precipitously, all of that Romanness has been shrinking and shrinking until here we are with no central organizing body to provide anything like these services. Except one. For points panel, do you know who that is? Let's start with you, Mary.
I'm not sure what we're talking about. Are you talking about a famous person? Is that what's going on?
More like an organizing body. How about you, Heather?
I mean, if we're talking about like the 250 years or so that Rome kind of started to collapse, about one central person? I mean, like I'm thinking Henry VIII, but like, because, right?
Not a person. Not a person.
Okay.
Aaron, how about you?
Okay, so this is before Constantine, so this wouldn't be the church. So 500, you know, we're talking about a sex cult. I'm going to get this wrong, but I'm going to go with like the cult of Mithras.
Oh, that's a great guess. That's a great guess. But no, it is in fact the Catholic Church. In the absence of anything else, the church, ostensibly dedicated to spiritual pursuits, has to become something like a government. This is when Christianity starts to become Christendom. They start taking care of taxation and education and money and the general organization of society.
Did you say 1534 initially? Did I get that wrong?
No, we're in the 500s.
So not Henry VIII. Got it. Go ahead.
No.
I heard 1534 at some point, and I was just like,
Oh, okay. We'll get there. We're going to get there.
Okay.
Plenty of sex cults to go around.
Yeah.
Then and now.
And so as they become a government, they start to develop the problems of a government. Corruption, an inefficient bureaucracy, and a constant need for money, although they never seemed to have any money. Fortunately, or sadly, the church was able to come up with a number of ways to make money off of their parishioners. Panel, for some more points, or some beginning points, I should say, name a few ways to monetize a religion. Aaron, we'll start with you.
I'm going to go with lay investiture, where you can buy a church office. And then you can also buy indulgences, where pay money and, so you killed an orphan. Hey, shit happens. Just, give me a fiver and we'll call it good.
Excellent. Heather?
I was going to go with that latter one as well, but I am going to say... I'm going to say just kind of your standard donations in the actual sanctuary itself.
I believe it's what the Goyim call tithing.
I was just going to say tithing.
I was worried I was going to mispronounce that since it's not of my tribe.
All right, Mary, we've got indulgences. We've got tithing. What you got?
What about some church perks?
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
In terms of goblets and sort of the things that they wear around their neck and it comes down and they're embroidered and all this kind of thing.
Oh.
It's very Trumpian, pre-Trumpian.
It goes beyond that. I will say that they did manage to monetize just about every aspect of the religion. Certainly they did sell indulgences, which cut down on your time in purgatory. If you were hellbound, an indulgence was not going to help you. You needed some other kind of clerical pardon, which were also for sale. They certainly had tithing, and they had a brisk economy in relics. So we're talking about
other people's sculptures.
Those were more public, PR projects. The relics were things like a splinter from the true cross.
Yeah. Right.
Or the, third metatarsal of Saint Anselm, things like that.
So it's all about saints and remnants and
yeah. I mean,
icons.
It was objects and it was anything that was you could say this is a Holy Grail or this is the coaster that the Holy Grail sat on. I mean, really anything.
There was a point in like the late Middle Ages where if you were a reasonably holy person, they were just waiting for you to keel over so they could boil you down and like sell all your bits.
Yeah. And this is not even including, various miraculous crying statues and
enough splinters of the true cross to build a barn.
Yeah. Things like that.
You mean locations of where miracles apparently happened, that kind
exactly. Blessed springs, groves, stuff like that.
What about pilgrimages though? Were pilgrimage part of that kind of thing where,
people
go on a road trip?
Yeah, people would go to visit the relics and it would give a lot of like cred.
Yeah,
think about how
it helped the economy as they were traveling, right?
Sure.
Whole culture of shrines is something that was very popular then and then was revived actually during the death of Princess Diana.
Yeah, absolutely. Think about Thomas a Becket, right? And how, the pilgrimage to Canterbury became a thing.
Right.
So we're going to fast forward 1,000 years. And here we are in the early 1500s. Now, at this point, there has been a full century of lascivious, corrupt, and hedonistic popes. The church owns vast amounts of land all over Europe and in the Holy Land. They own vineyards and breweries and farms and estates. The monasteries and cathedrals control the economies of all the regions they are in. They tax virtually every service and every good produced by these small towns and big cities. They control education, they steer politics, and they even control the calendar. And, as you may have heard, all of this corruption and secular mishigas became too much for a constipated priest named Martin Luther. His Protestant Reformation called for the end of all of the sects, all the money, all the gold statues and cathedrals, the relics, the saints, right? Their code was solo fide, faith alone, is what his Christianity was all about. Anyone could talk to God, and anyone could now read Martin Luther's newly translated Bible. And they did. People devoured the vernacular Bible, and more than that, they developed opinions about it. And then they talked about these opinions with each other. And this made the power structure very, very nervous. The reason why is this character in the Bible that people were now reading about. His name was Jesus.
I've heard of him. Yeah.
And there was a real disparity between what people were now reading Jesus said and what they had been told, especially about the sort of medieval chain of existence. It turns out Jesus said you should help the poor and the meek and didn't mention anything about God ordaining that peasants should be peasants or the universe would fall apart. And so what we have now is a increasingly educated populace that does most of the work being pit against a small, wealthy, powerful elite of religious and political leaders. Any parallels you see with anything going on
right
at
now?
All? Yeah. Now?
Yeah. Yes. The oligarchy, the aristocracy, the whole kind of class warfare that is going on right now. The gap between the peasants and the overlords.
And what's interesting is that the creation of this kind of goes against what we think of as economic theory, right? This is in the wake of the plague, and a large number of the workforce has died off. And so the peasants that are existing are demanding higher wages. They're demanding more rights. They're demanding an end to serfdom. And rather than the hand of economics saying, well, you know, if you want peasants to work for you, you got to pay them better. All the nobles are saying, we don't care what you want. We don't care how many of you there are. You are divinely ordained to work on this piece of land and raise potatoes for me until you die. And so I think that is what kind of puts a spin on this rather than, you know, our current and recent Gilded Ages. What do you guys think?
I just wrote like a long screed about like basically exactly this and like the idea of like, because this is right when the Gutenberg printing press came out, and that's like why, you know, the Lutheran Bible took off. And I'm like, I just wrote this long paper about like every time there's like a huge jump forward in communications tech, like there's like just massive discord, you know, or in the 30 years war, and just like shit all goes to pot for like a while. And that's just like the deal in history. This would take too like long and be outside the scope of this, but it's just funny because I like literally just wrote a screed about this.
I like that you refer to your writing as a screed. I picture something written in all caps with like three lines of text on every line of paper.
If you imagine it like spit flecked, you have the right idea. Yeah. No, it's okay.
So keeping in mind this is all in the early 1500s, see if you can name some of the peasants' demands. Let's start with you, Heather.
Oh, a demand from a peasant? Yeah. Besides being able to earn beyond just the indentured servitude of it, but maybe to have their own parcel.
Okay. Mary, and you have any thoughts?
Well, I think their own representation in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily voting, but some kind of lotteries or some way that they could make themselves identifiable.
And Aaron, any thoughts?
I might be fucking this all up, but as I recall, like, there were huge fights at the time on which holidays were recognized, and also, like, so they were required to, like, turn in a certain amount of, like, grain or whatever you're doing, and the way you measured that led to just, like, massive discord, because, like, is the bowl heaping, or is it flat? And this was, like, just a continuous form of strife.
And was the word heaping and all that, like those words were the ones that were contentious? because of their inaccuracy?
Well, so it's like, okay, you have to do this many. They have like a measuring device, but it's different for every county, and it wasn't standardized. And how it's defined was like continuous fighting. It's like some of this like just like kept going into like the Napoleonic code.
Well, panel, you guys are far less radical than medieval peasants. They called for the end of all hereditary rulers and lords, basically to abolish the nobility. They demanded popular elections where women could vote. All banks and financial institutions should be abolished. There should be free education for everyone.
So it's like the guy in New York. The new, you know, the one who sort of, I mean, it's that kind of activism where, you know, the whole thought about the order is disrupted. You know, well, I think I mean, that it's, what you're talking about is, you know, innovative disruption.
Look,
well, it's progressive socialism, basically.
Yeah.
I guess, like, people ask for this, but then why were they born a peasant? I mean, well, to me, that's just ridiculous.
Right. That's true.
So here we are in 1524. You can imagine that if this stuff sounds sort of radical now in 2025, European nobility was shitting their pants about this stuff. And there were several peasant revolts, and they resulted in a lot of dead peasants.
But if,
so,
if they buy out CBS, then they'll have two networks preaching to those serfs that nobles should be there. Just but no.
Exactly.
And no comedians.
And no comedians.
Oh, they're the worst. Yeah, you can't.
Right.
I mean, this is the absolute worst
kill
people.
The comedians is what is going on now. I mean, did you see Court Colbert tonight? Just so sad.
I didn't see it tonight, but I am behind you guys.
So here we are on the precipice. Before we go forward, let's tally some scores. Looking here, it is a close one. Aaron, you are in third place currently with 7 points. Heather, you're in second place with 8. Mary, you're currently in the lead with 9 points as we enter round 2. Let's go to Germany. Specifically, to the city of Münster, like the cheese, in central Westphalia, like the ham. Münster experienced the same peasants versus noble tension that the rest of Europe was undergoing. The town was run by the Catholic Prince Bishop Franz von Waldeck. Opposing him in city politics was a collection of powerful Anabaptists. They were all virulent anti-Catholics. One of these guys was Bernard Knipperdolling. He wanted to make Münster the center of the Anabaptist movement, and the Anabaptists basically wanted to return to a much more primitive Christian church. They wanted to ditch all the hierarchy and sort of Catholic and Roman sort of accoutrements and go back to when priests looked and acted much more like Jesus and less like kings. So, Knipperdolling had a printing press, and he printed pamphlets, and he sent them all over Europe, summoning Anabaptists far and wide, and he told them to come to Münster as fast as they possibly could. And they should do this because that's where the end of the world would happen, and where all the wealth of the town would be split up and distributed to everyone who showed up. They would be the elect of heaven, and everyone would be rich and live in paradise. So talk to me if you have any thoughts on this. It's a weird Protestant communist cocktail. And how does that work?
It sounds to me like rapture psychology or conspiracy or that same kind of promise of a heavenly future, right?
Doesn't this lead to like Amish and Mennonites and like migration?
Eventually, that's who the Anabaptists
like
become.
So yeah, the Mennonites.
What's the time frame between what you're talking about and those groups that migrated to us?
About 300-400 years.
Okay.
It's my ancestral religion, actually. So. No, really. Like, my family's Mennonite.
Radical, it was
your family's
the
Mennonite?
Post-Lutheran religion in Europe.
Hold on, Hale. Hold on just one
Wait,
second.
Wait, what does that mean, Aaron?
What does that mean?
It's Diet Coke Amish. Yeah, it's like when you're like Amish, but you don't really want to commit to it. You know, that sounds like a lot of work, and it's a pain in the ass. And you have to like grow the beard, but shave the mustache. Like,
did you make your own furniture? Or like all that stuff? Or?
This is totally taking this thing off the rails. But you know, yeah, they separate from the English. They have a sect of they speak Low German, which I know like five words in. Like, I didn't grow up in this. This is my grandparents.
Got it. Fascinating.
So this would be your great-grandparents or grandparents?
This is my grandparents were a Mennonite.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
As I understand it, Mennonites look like Amish, but they can use electronics?
Well, so the Amish can also they can't be on grid, but they use a lot more tech than people realize. Like, and like, if you're Amish and you build a house, you'll actually wire it up, but you won't put in the plugs because you can sell the house for more.
Oh, okay.
But no, they there's differences. Like, they dress a little bit differently. Like I said, the Mennonites will grow the mustache. They're still separated from like English culture, which is just what they call everybody else. And they're just, you know, they're just, the Amish can be thought of as extremist Mennonites, but they're still separate from English culture
And what's everyone. Nice is that we can say no pretty much anything we want about them because they're probably not listening.
No, all what the time. The love podcasts. Hate electricity, love podcasts. Every single one of them. Like, it's a big thing.
But they all came from the Anabaptists.
Yeah.
Interesting. I got you back there, Phil. Did you see that?
I did. Thank you. So here we are in Munster, and Bernard Knipperdolling has just summoned every Anabaptist in Europe to this city with a promise of religious salvation and free money. As you might expect, Anabaptists began flooding the city. At the same time, also unsurprisingly, nervous Catholics started to leave. And with so many new Anabaptist adherents now flocking to Munster, Knipperdolling and his friends easily took over the town in the next round of elections. He's made mayor of Munster, and he ousted any Catholics from the government. Panel, does any of this feel familiar?
So the thing I'm going to get wrong about this is, like, I think, so the thing is, I'm getting my years wrong. So, like, we're in Westphalia. I'm thinking about the Treaty of Westphalia, which is like where Protestants and Catholics were like, all right, we'll stop trying to kill each other within our borders. But I think I'm getting the year off about 100 years.
Yeah, you're a couple of 100 years off.
Yeah, fuck.
So, I mean, we see a creeping takeover of the government today. We've seen it in the recent past. What makes this one different, or is it not different? Is this just the same old, same old?
Well, don't you think the religious aspect and the boundaries between religions and the state, the conflation of church and state is important here, as it is here? I think, you know, the church and state are flooding together right now, as a matter of fact.
Well, this is before Voltaire, so it's like it just would have been synonymous.
Like, well, that's the thing. I mean, we're kind of coming at this with contemporary ideas of church and state and economies. I'm throwing around the term communism, but I mean, capitalism hasn't been invented yet, right? I mean, the economy is throwing out like a purse to an innkeeper and saying, feed the horse.
I mean, I'm guessing this all ends in an awesome, like, you know, orgy-tastic sex cult is my hope, but, you know, maybe I'm wrong.
Well,
but I hope
close,
that about literally
let's not
everything.
Get too far out over our skis.
Okay. Okay. Like, that's what I hope with everything. Like, it's Friday night.
And we have been promised the sex cult. I'm just saying.
Now, everyone I've described so far has had deeply held convictions and principles, albeit radical ones, but they seem to all be working within a certain level of reality, right? They're dealing with politics. They might be rigging elections, but they're still dealing with elections. This is not the case for Jan Matthijs. Let me tell you now of Jan Matthijs. Jan was a Dutch baker who underwent a religious conversion to Anabaptism in the 1520s and had since dedicated his life to the cause. He had personally baptized a couple of thousand people throughout Northern Europe and had gathered quite a following. And this is literally, I mean, people would follow him around. He was a very much a charismatic leader. By all accounts, he was hypnotic. Contemporary reports talk about his eyes shining with a divine light, and he had a holy air about him. And so people were just kind of would fall into his personality. In addition to this, he claimed to speak directly with God and would pass on new and updated commandments and information from the Almighty directly to his followers. And this was in real time. So we're not talking about, you know, him, you know, appearing in a church and saying, you know, the Lord has spoken to me. It's more like, do you remember on Mork and Mindy, there's a character named Exeter who was sort of a street loony and who had an invisible friend who he would occasionally talk to and only he could hear. So it's that kind of setup, right? Where he's walking down the street or he's talking to someone and all of a sudden God taps him on the shoulder and he's like, what's that, Lord? Oh, I'll tell them. And that's how he passed on, you know, the word of God. And it seems like one of two things happens to guys like this. Either they're laughed at or maybe pitied and then sent away to, a soft padded room, or they amass a following of thousands of fanatical devotees who will follow their every order. Panel, for some points, which one of these do you think happens to Jan Matthias? Mary, let's start with you.
I'd say the second one.
Well, good guess. That's a very good guess.
He becomes a charismatic leader.
My guess is nothing happens, and that's why we don't remember him.
Interesting. All right.
I'm guessing.
That's a bold choice. I feel like that's the historical equivalent of bidding a dollar on a Price is Right.
Yeah, no, that's. I think it's bold. Right. I'm going with it.
Okay.
And even $2 could be over. I'm thinking it's first one and then kind of the other. So building a very vast following and then somehow pissing them all off. That's what
does
I'm
he
going
become for. Somebody else? Does he change his name?
If you start off as a cult leader, it always ends well for you. He probably just retired somewhere. Like, I'm sure it's fine.
All right, well, let's find out. Matthias enters Munster with his followers, numbering in the, you know, couple of thousand, and his chief disciple and PR man, Jan van Leyden. Matthias declares Munster to be the new Jerusalem and starts baptizing people. Now, the guys who are currently controlling Munster, Knipperdaling and another guy named Bernard Rothman, have a choice here. They can initiate some sort of sectarian conflict and call into question this guy's sanity or authority or divinity, or they can throw in with him. And that's what they did. They went all in on Jan Matthias and basically made him the de facto voice of God. And what followed was described as an orgy of iconoclasm. Every bit of church art, every bit of finery in all the Catholic churches and cathedrals in Munster was destroyed. Illuminated Bibles, communion chalices, all of that.
It's always all or nothing with religion.
Well, I think that's the big attraction and the big terror, I think. If your a priori assumption is that the omniscient creator of the universe told me what to do, then you have carte blanche to do anything with complete
But also, there are always malignant narcissists in culture who attract these followings. And I think it's those who are personality disordered and very attractive and incredibly charismatic that attract the following. And so I think it has to do with that kind of, the it guy.
But wouldn't it be weird if you didn't? Like, you're like, no, the an omniscient, omnibenevolent, perfect being is telling me what to do. But like, don't like chill out about it. It's not like a big deal. Like, let's kind of keep this on the down low. Like,
right.
I mean, that'd be weird, right? Like, let's not make a huge thing about it.
And here's the other thing is that, you talk about malignant personalities. And certainly someone like Jim Jones is fully aware of his impact.
Exactly, yeah.
Right? It's not clear whether Jan Matthijs was that cynical and that calculating, or whether it was really his PR guy, this guy Jan van Leyden.
I'm imagining Flava Flav with a lot of black wool and like Flemish cap.
You know, I see him as a very Sergeant Bilko kind of character.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, always scheming.
Not Stephen Miller?
Edmund Blackadder, something like that.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Just like, you know, stroking his pointed oiled mustache.
Yeah, you know.
I feel like Rasputin has come up a lot in these episodes, and I'm like, anytime we're in that beard and skeeving, you know, place, it's like, that's what comes to mind for me.
Yeah, it's like everyone graduated from evil counselor school, and they got their diploma and their snake-headed staff.
I went to the correspondence evil scout counselor school, which is pretty abridged. It's not that great.
As long as you get the accreditation, that's what's important.
That's what I thought next, at the time.
For Munster come the edicts. And these come directly from God via Jan Matthijs, of course. First off, all the Catholics got to get out of town. They couldn't take any of their stuff, but they weren't being executed yet. That would come later for any unbelievers. So probably they should be grateful. Next, adult baptism becomes compulsory, and all property is declared communal and starts being redistributed. Is this communism? And this is for points. Aaron?
All right. I think the serious answer is this is thing from the Pope's encyclical, the previous Pope, Francis, about reading the early church founders would send modern contemporaries screaming to the safety of Marx and Lenin. But I've read Capital, and I like the part in it where they said, you know, a rich man will enter heaven as easily as he passes through the camel goes through the eye of a needle.
Needle.
I think that's in the beginning. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Communism
is pretty, I think, communism is like pretty chill compared to like a lot of like the more egalitarian, like Christian sects. I mean, like, you know, like living under, like Castro is like, you know, it sucked, but it was like very, relaxed compared to like being in like a mendicant order where you're like, okay, you can have a robe and you can have a belt if you're lucky.
Right, but what are we dealing with here? What do you think we're more...
I think at this point you're boiling communism down into like something it's not. It's a little bit too... it's simplifying a complex thing, and this is doing something a little bit different in both aspect and type.
Well, it's autocracy. It's a kind of pre-autocracy, which I think we've been redefining how these evolutions are, I mean, at least in contemporary culture. So there's kind of something autocratic about it, but not quite the notion a Marxian notion the whole idea of the bourgeoisie and the classes and all that, and the evolution.
I think that was my question had to do with, are we talking about a flattening of the hierarchical economy structure, or is it just from these people down, it's all communal? Because that's kind of what we're experiencing, right? Is like...
Right. Well, certainly the voice of God and the people running things, you know, they have to eat the best food and you know, get the stuff in the houses. But basically, we're taking all the gold in the city, plates and coins and whatever, and melting it down and reminting it and handing it out. Is it communism? Is it not? I mean, certainly... I like to call them commies because it amuses me. but I think, you know, there is a sort of proto-communism inherent in Christianity. And I think that's what these guys are sort of glomming onto. Among the expelled Catholics is the Prince Bishop, who, as you may guess, wants his city back. Additionally, his fellow Catholic princes for sure don't want this pinko bullshit spreading to their cities. So they all pitch in, and Munster is surrounded and besieged by a large, professional, very Catholic army. The people of Munster, psyched as they are for all the free stuff and Jesus coming back, are not super-duper pumped about being besieged. So in order to quell any uncertainty, Jan Matthias executes the first person who complains about it. The execution was public, with no trial or any due process, which is unusual for Munster. They had a fairly robust judiciary and all of that stuff. Some people complain about this, and they are summarily killed. These public executions, along with some ongoing communal religious fervor,
I'm sensing panic.
Yeah. So, you know, the executions quell any large public outcry, so they're successful, I guess. And Jan Matthias is now de facto dictator of Munster. Aaron, you had something to say?
Oh, it's just like, I love the second guy. Like, the first guy who comes up and is like, you know, like, this kind of sucks and gets, like, ganked right there on the spot. Like, you know, he didn't know it was coming. But the second guy who comes up and is like, hey, maybe you shouldn't have executed that guy. That guy should have known better.
It's even worse than that, because that first execution was a bloody mess. They tried cutting his head off, and they missed three times. And eventually they shot him, and he still lived on, so they dragged him off.
See?
It's like if you're on the Imperial Star Destroyer and Vader chokes a guy out because he's like, you know, talking shit about your religion. And then you immediately go, hey, enough of that. But no, really, your religion sucks. Like, let's be real about this. And you look like it's like a samurai dipped in plastic. What is this about? Like, you're going to get force choked. And you should have known better.
No lesson learned.
You have the example. Like, you know, and that's funny to me. Like, I think there's a certain boldness / like naivete to like what was coming. Like,
although bravery in groups, right, has to start with those that see the potential of their own doom, right, in order to speak up. So I'm wondering if that was like the self-righteousness going on, like, it's really up to us to continue this guy's message.
First they came to the prince bishop, and I did not say anything, for I was not a prince bishop.
Well, you should work on that. Like, put that on your... It looks great on a LinkedIn.
But there's a kind of Lord of the Flies piece to this, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's definitely a rarefied, weird environment inside this walled city that is now surrounded by an army. So no one's getting in or out, including food. And so people are starting to go...
And only this one guy has the conch.
Right.
And Jennifer Lawrence is not there yet.
No, not a bit. So, panel, sounds like the Anabaptists have it all sewn up in Munster, but there is a catch. What is that catch?
Well, I mean, if this guy has a direct line to God, that's got to be, like, tactically pretty useful, I would think. You know,
okay.
Like, so, you know, well done, Jan.
Heather, what do you think the catch is? What's the fly in the ointment here for the Anabaptists?
Circling back to what this episode is supposed to be about, which is sex cult. Was Jan secretly in a sex cult, and thus his flaws were discovered by his pure followers?
Okay.
At some point here, they've got to turn on Jan.
Was there Kool-Aid? Well, I just wonder if there was Kool-Aid involved in any way, and I'm using that as a trope, you know, in terms of death.
Right.
Was it a death cult?
Well, funny you mention that. The catch, by the way, you're all incorrect. The catch is the army of 25,000 mercenaries surrounding the city. Now, the populace, filled with the certainty that they are God's chosen, the new Israelites.
Yes.
Yeah. Destined to spend property-free socialist paradise from Munster to the rest of the world, is still surrounded, trapped, and rapidly running out of food. Fortunately, you'll never guess what happened. That's right. Jan Matthias has received another message from God.
That's my man.
Yep. Don't worry. God has told him that, like Daniel and Moses, he will also help out Matthias. Jan announces he will ride out and face down the Prince Bishop's army by himself. And with the help of God, destroy them. So 5 days later, at dawn.
I feel like he needs to have a word with God on that particular missive.
I like how he can take them all out, but he needs 5 days to prep.
5 days later, at dawn, the gates of Munster swing open, and out rides Jan Matthias in full armor, lance held high. He gives a short prayer and charges the Prince Bishop's lines. Panel, for the easiest points you've ever got, how well does this go? Start with you, Mary.
I don't know. I'm thinking Achilles, you know, in Iliad. Not too well.
Excellent. Heather?
Oh, this guy's getting, like, drawn, quartered. There's going to be some ceremonial. Check this out, people inside the town. Like, Munster's going to see what happened to this guy real fast.
And Aaron?
I'm imagining, like, you know, it's just, like, hilarious. Like, Enter the Gladiator starts playing, and then he, like, trips over his thing, and, like, you know, it becomes, like, a sort of, like, unicycle and spinny plates.
Very cheesy.
Yeah.
Well, you are all correct. Matthias is slaughtered immediately, and the Prince Bishop's men nail his dick to the city gates. These developments throw just the tiniest kink into Matthias's credibility as God's chosen messenger. Thankfully, for the citizens of Munster, he was not our only Jan. And this brings us to the end of round two on that cliffhanger. Let's take a look at the scores. Well, it is still a barn burner here. Heather has captured first place with 31 points. Aaron is in second place with 29, and Mary in third place with 26. As we enter into round three, Jan von Leiden takes over. Almost immediately after Matthias' death, Jan announces that he has, now stay with me here, received a message from God, and it is exactly the same shtick. God whispers messages in his ear, and then these whispers become law immediately. And everyone goes for it. Everyone goes for it. This is what communal religious fervor coupled with a total authoritarian takeover, which kind of skews the sense of reality, plus maybe surviving on, you know, 2 calories of boiled shoelaces worth of nutrition every day. You'll
never
guess.
But there's a whole theory.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say there's a whole theory about cult leaders having schizophrenia. And the same is true of great artists and the theory about schizophrenia. You know that it's not a negative thing, it's a positive thing and all this kind of thing. You know, it's sort of the myth of mental illness. And at the center is hearing voices. You know, what about hearing voices and all these people?
Well, I think Matthias falls into what you describe. Obviously, he felt a conviction of it. He thought God told him to run out and take on this army, and so he did it. I think Jan von Leiden is a much more cynical political player. I think he saw an opportunity to take over, and he did.
It's like my grandmother used to say, you know, generally speaking, like, anything that gets your dick nailed to a city gate is maladaptive, and you don't want to do that. Like,
that's true. You know.
Yeah. Well, wise words. Wise words.
She was a clever woman.
Well, you guys, you'll never guess what God said to Jan von Leiden. God wants him to be in charge.
Of course.
It's amazing. And he goes full tyrant. He declares,
who wants to be in charge of Munster at this point? Like, what does it get you to be in charge of Munster surrounded by 25,000 troops? Like,
You don't like cheese?
Well, I think what it gets him at this point is food, right? He's in charge of, you know, of the army such as it is inside. He's in control of the government. And this is where we tip into it, because what he gets is food and sex. He goes full tyrant, declaring pretty much anything punishable by death, especially anything mentioned in the Book of Leviticus. And this goes double for anyone who complains about anything or says anything bad about him. You know, your very sort of classic fascist tyrant takeover. The only way to get these death sentences commuted is from a personal pardon from von Leiden himself. and he's hungry. Oh, also, Gal told him to start banging beyond Matthias's wife, which he does. In fact, adultery is the one crime Van Leyden does dial back on. Because apparently, he is screwing every woman he can find. And he is not having any trouble being, you know, the leper with the most fingers here in Munster. Some people do look askance at this new development, but instead of trying to explain it or obfuscate, Van Leyden triples down on it. Not only has God declared adultery is no longer a sin, the same holds true for polygamy. That's no longer a sin. In fact, fuck it. Polygamy is now mandatory in Munster, as are orgies.
Now, the whole polygamy thing, I don't know. I couldn't help but think about the whole plates during this whole discussion with, you know, Brigham Young and all of them. And, you know, and then when Mary was talking about the whole, you know, hearing voices thing, I mean, we've got obviously repeating histories happening.
Well, I think, you know, the quote unquote scriptural excuse is that, well, all these, you know, ancient Hebrew kings had 17 wives, so that must be, and it's in the Bible, so it must be good. I think in Van Leyden's case, he just wanted to sleep with a bunch of people.
Now, Phil, that is an extremely ungenerous interpretation of our guy Leyden. Like, and, you know, like, honestly, I think, you know, like, you know, he's hearing directly from God. Like, you know, I'm willing to hear him out.
Well, let me ask you, panel. How do you think the conservative Lutheran population of Munster took to federally mandated orgies? Let's start with you, Heather.
I mean, I think to myself that during the, you know, the Victorian era, when things were so rigid and high-laced, we had some of the most, you know, bloody or sexualized, you know, moments in history. And I have to think that maybe the Lutherans were like, hell yeah. Like, they were like, we finally have license to do something that we've been forbidden to do this whole time. Okay, did I guess Mary? Wrong?
Well, it's much called a reaction time. Formation. I mean, they do exactly what they, it's the opposite of what they, what you were saying, Heather, what they do the opposite of what they have right. been. And it's about unrepressing everything.
Yeah. Like the Pandora's box has been opened.
Aaron?
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm from I'm from an Anabaptist family, and like, you know, like I remember like it being a big stink that they had too much garlic in food because it was like considered sinful. So I'm guessing they didn't like it, but I think I found a new policy plank that I'm going to start advocating for going forward.
And Aaron is correct. They were not thrilled about having to act like they were from the Old Testament. With the exception Van Leyden and his inner circle, which really has turned into some sort of polyamorous kind of weird, you know, Hitler in the bunker kind of unreality sex club. Meanwhile, the siege continues. Nothing is getting in and out of Munster. God, via Van Leyden, continues to insist that it is deeply important that the peasants subsist on twigs and rats while Jan and his buddies get all the good food. The people of Munster are maybe starting to get a little suspicious. There's some rumbling. And so Van Leyden picks up on this and declares that there has been, you'll never guess, a message from God. God will lift the siege and deliver them all on Easter Day. So panel, for some more points, did God save them on Easter? Mary, let's start with you.
No.
Correct. Aaron?
I'm also going to go with no.
Correct. Heather?
Since you've already said no.
You guys are some hot shit, I tell you what. No, he did not. And it's at this point, someone, and the historical record does not record who. Basically, it comes down to kind of a random Munsterite, right? A blacksmith, steps forward and these are sort of, these proclamations are happening, you know.
That was really specific. He's not just a random Munsterite. He's a blacksmith. We know that.
Wait, some people say he's a blacksmith. Some people aren't sure. Basically, all these edicts are being delivered from kind of a balcony in the former Prince Bishop's residence to a town square. And so someone steps forward and announces that God has spoken to him. And apparently,
I'm Spartacus.
What God really wanted was for the town to surrender to the Prince Bishop and hand over Van Leiden, Rothman, and Knipperdolling.
I'm more.
I'm imagining this in like a thick Brooklyn accent. Yeah, no, I heard that. And he said, this guy can fuck off, like right the fuck off.
I mean, essentially, it feels like everyone just kind of had enough at one point. But
I feel like you want to name my dog Knipperdolly. I'm just saying we've said it now a few times, and I'm like, Knipperdolly, here, Knipperdolly.
Oh, it's awesome. So it's a very euphonious name, Knipperdolling.
Knipperdolly.
It's but all maybe, good, though.
You know, the other thing point. Is, the other thing is, can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
The pleasure principle here is what is underneath everything, right? But it bothers.
You mean it bothers people to
be able to do anything they want?
Pleasure, yeah.
To you know, yeah. It's like this id kind of thing where you know it's just too intense. They want to go back into the womb. And
well, I think I think it really comes down to they want to eat, right? I mean, yeah. They've been promised that this is, you know, that Jesus is going to be there any second.
Oh, it's not just a moral compass thing. It's a I'm hungry.
It's a stomach thing.
Yeah, well, I think they got into this feedback loop of religious fervor and starvation.
I think, you know, and I don't speak for everyone, but don't like, and this might be a little bit of a spicy take. I don't like tin pot Hitlers and starving, you know, and you know, I think that's, you know, the like 60% of people don't like those things, you know, at least.
Well, and I think even for the religious fanatics, and certainly from a modern lens, we would view even like the average, you know, 1500s European as a religious fanatic. And these are even more fervent than that. I think, you know, you're promised this ultimate deliverance and an end to money and property and, you know, and everyone's going to be rich and happy and saved forever. And you're willing to put up with a certain amount, especially when someone is, you know, giving you the skinny directly from the Almighty. But at this point, I feel like they haven't really delivered on the promises. And so, you know, there's only so much people will put up with. All of this, though, is moot because the Prince Bishop's forces infiltrate the city one night by bribing one of the guards at the watchtower with some food. And they come in with about 7 guys and open the gate to the rest of the army. The Prince Bishop's army rush in and kill many, many, many people.
They're not going to tiptoe in. It's an army.
No, they're going to come in, and they killed a lot of people in Munster, thousands of people. Who they do not kill, however, is Jan van Leiden and Bernard Knipperdolling. Instead, those two were taken to Rome and torn apart with hot irons, and their remains were brought back to Munster and hung in cages outside the cathedral. And you can see these cages on hanging from the cathedral in Munster to this very day.
Wow.
Wow.
Yep. And so, panel, what do you think? What have we learned?
Knipperdolling might be a really cool verb. I don't know. I'm going with this Knipperdolling. I'm having a great time with it.
Do you like Knipperdolling? I don't know. I've never Knipperdolled.
Would you like to come back to my place and try?
Knipperdolling. Well, it also ranks up there with the word splunking. Like there's something. It's a different way of it's a different hobby.
I like when you were like, okay, medieval orgy cult, and I was like thinking like I got the wrong 3 cults, right? And it's just like I think that's kind of like a thing. I'm like, oh no, not this cult or not that orgy cult.
You weren't expecting what? Protestants. You weren't expecting Lutherans.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, because, you know, England had this whole thing in, like, the, like shortly after the American Revolution, where they just had, like, a fuck ton of these. And I think the only one left is the Society of Friends. But
Is that Quakers?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the same group.
Yeah.
Quakers? As a set? Did I miss something there?
No, they don't. They were an apocalypse cult that just kind of chilled out about the apocalypse. Yeah, George Fox.
Mm. Fascinating.
Here we have the Shakers.
They're all gone.
Right here.
Well,
we have all the remnants of Shakers.
Any other lessons from the town of Munster and their brief flirtation with communism?
Well, when I do my, like, communist dictatorship sex cult, it'll be better. Like, you know, like, those guys, it went terrible. But, like, when I try it, I'll have the secret sauce, and it will go great for me.
More fun.
Yeah.
Well, you know, more fun seems to be the key to defeating any kind of communist cult. You know, Western culture, once it spread into behind the Iron Curtain, you saw that, you know,
they love the blue jeans, man.
Blue jeans and Metallica concerts.
Yeah.
Right.
Mary, any thoughts on the city of Munster?
I think, you know, you'd first think it was an object lesson, but then you get into, you know, sort of the whole idea of what is the aim of civilization, and civilization and its discontents, as Freud would say. And I think that it's never going to be content. We're always discontented in some way. And that's good.
Well, yeah, I think that provides a dynamic for progress and examination.
Yeah, innovation and futurism and that. That's
right.
True.
I mean, you know, it's like the phrase more perfect nation, right? Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. You can't make something more perfect. You can only try and make something more perfect.
And then it bends towards justice, or it bends towards something more positive.
Hopefully.
I don't know whether it does or not.
Well, that was our final round, pal. Thank you for all of your insights. I have tallied our scores and am about to reveal who is, in fact, going to replace Jan van Leyden as the direct conduit to God, and also get a box of Captain Crunch cereal.
Even better.
Excellent. Well, let's take a look here. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Going into that round, we had a tight match. Heather with 38, Mary with 33, and Aaron with 39. After awarding the final points, we have Mary in third place with 41 points. Heather coming in second with 43, but tonight's champion and a winner with 46 points is Aaron Clark. Congratulations, Aaron.
Good going.
Cool, having a direct conduit to God, kind of cool, but the Captain Crunch cereal, I'm pretty excited for. Like, that's, yeah.
I'll get you a box of the Oops All Anabaptist Captain Crunch.
That's my favorite. Yeah, that's the best one.
Had Jan only had Captain Crunch.
It's actually just bran. Like, it's very dour. And, you know, the box, the puzzle's already filled out because John Calvin said so.
Well, it's all predetermined.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it for this week's Wait What. Congrats to this week's winner, Aaron. And special thank you to our other panelists, Heather Walpert-Garin and Mary Valentis. Thanks, guys. We'll catch you next week when we once more clutch the dagger of knowledge between our teeth and take another dive into the murky depths of human history, prying the pearl of wisdom from the clam of obscurity. Please do all the podcast things, comment, share, subscribe, and talk about us on all your socials. Thanks so much, everyone, and good night. Wait What is hosted, written, and researched by me, Phil Ahrensberg. The show is edited by Dern Gleaves, and our music is by Wesley Devine.